But the way he's doing it seems so ham-handed. So, well, it ultimately backfires. The example in question is the Increasing Offenders Accountability for Victims Act. This is one in a series of tough-on-crime bills like Tackling Violent Crime Act, the Truth in Sentencing Act, and Protecting Children from Internet Predators Act. Although the title lays clear the propaganda and political point he's trying to score, the laws themselves leave much to be desired, even from a pro-conservative perspective. The biggest problem Harper has with these ideological laws has been the courts. The law that is currently our focus, Increasing Offenders Accountability for Victims Act, is one such law that has recently been nullified by the court. Before I go on, I should explain that the law's impact, its intent, and the bait and switch Harper's pulling with this kind of legislation. In a modern society, there are three primary actors in crime. There's the perpetrator, the criminal, there's the victim, and then there's the state. The state is important in the evolution of justice, but more on that later. Now, sometimes the victim is the state, as in not paying your taxes. Sometimes the victim is the criminal themselves, think drug use. But most times, it's another individual, think robbery or the like. Often the victim requires more than just justice, more than just having the criminal found guilty and sentenced. What do I mean? Well, for those criminals who are their own victims, drug rehabilitation may be in order. For those people who may be the subject to physical, psychological, or sexual assault, these victims often require additional medical, mental, and social support, be that support groups, physiotherapy, time with a psychologist, care needed to make the victim whole again. In a logical, proper, socially responsible state, these victims would, like any other member of society, receive this support as part of the social safety net. This treatment would be based on their need and not on the cause of their need. Let's use for an example, a fractured arm. X-rays are taken, the bone is set, and a cast is applied. There's no question such as who did it, the reason why they did it, because those inquiries have nothing to do with your care. Expanding on the fractured arm analogy, if the fracture was a result of slipping on an icy sidewalk, and because of that fall, one has an overwhelming fear of venturing outside, so you're now a prisoner in your own home for fear of another fall. Or your injury was a result of a robbery in an alleyway and you are deathly afraid to leave your home. Your need of psychological care is the same. One should not be treated as more needy or less needy than the other. A responsible state would treat both equally in quality, quantity, and timeliness. Well, now let's return to the Increasing Offenders Accountability for Victims Act. What this act did was make mandatory a surcharge on all offenders. This money would be used to provide victim services. Now, from an ideological point of view, it's a sound law. Let's kick on those dirty, rotten criminals. They did the crime, and they should be made to pay and pay and pay again. Although it should point out that the money does not actually go to the specific victim, but sort of to all victims in general, as in it's placed in a pool that social services can draw upon in general. It obviously provides an additional punitive punishment above and beyond the actual sentencing for the crime and any fines assessed. And one could have a debate about punishment being a deterrent, they're not, or that there is a visceral vengeance to do this, which I think we've evolved beyond. But no, I'm not going to make that argument here for the moment. We'll focus, as Harper government claims to, on the victim. So first, the impact. As I've already mentioned, the law has been nullified. I say nullified because it is yet to be struck down by the Supreme Court, but in lower courts, the law has been judged to be unconstitutional and deemed cruel and unusual punishment. Why was it deemed unconstitutional? Well, the status of the surcharge in existence prior to Harper was applied at the judge's discretion. The judge could take into account the criminal's ability to pay, but Harper made the surcharge mandatory, and thus, according to the judiciary and myself, victimizes the criminal for no other purpose than vengeance. So everyone must pay the surcharge. For instance, a drug addict who, because of an addiction to drugs, is already forced to steal to feed their drug habit, where's the drug addict going to come up with the money to pay the fine? A recovering addict who's kicked out of his apartment because he's missed a month's rent, thus making it more likely that he will relapse. People who are trying to turn their lives around but must take time off of work for childcare because they have no money for daycare. They could lose their job because Harper needs the money more than the landlord. There's a term for this, penny wise and pound foolish. You can't get blood from a stone, and many criminals simply can't pay. So the government then sells these uncollected fines to debt collectors, thus placing the criminal, who we've just said may be attempting to turn their life around or coping with issues like drug addiction, these people are then thrown to the debt collector hyenas, who often make their lives even less tolerable with questionable collection techniques. But again, you may have no sympathies for these people. Off with their heads, you might say. Okay, well then what about the intent of the law? Well, ostensibly the surcharge is supposed to pay for victim services. Does it? No, you see, these services have these things called budgets. And unlike the one Harper presents to Parliament, they are not political documents, but actual financial plans of incomings and outgoings. In order to plan for what services can be offered to how many people and how many places across the country, let us remember we are a vast nation where crime has no geographical preference. Well, to plan, you need to know how much money you can count on. And therein lies the rub. Thanks to the law and its mandatory nature, on paper, these agencies can hope to get, well, I don't really have any hard numbers, but let's say for the sake of this thought experiment, they think they're going to get $1 million. But as it turns out, over half of those mandatory surcharges are never collected because the criminals in question have no money to pay. So the agency actually gets $500,000, a quarter, three quarters, who knows? The point being, they can't make long-term plans because they lack reliable funding. This can be costly as well. Because if you know you can rent a space for a year, at least maybe half the cost of renting month to month. You get the point. And this leads to my whine, the bait and switch. The thing that exposes the ugly underbelly, the true contempt the Harper government actually has for its own citizens. The example that shows the hypocrisy of his legislation's lofty title to its actual impact on Canadians. You might be saying, Don, what the hell are you talking about? You didn't notice? This type of legislation, one in a long and continuing line, shifts the responsibility of social services from the government to others. So if victim services are experiencing a budget shortfall, it's not because the government's cutting back. No, the government is off the hook because really it's the fault of those deadbeat criminals not paying their fines, which plays in the conservative narrative because they can then justify even more draconian laws because, well, think of the poor victims of crime. This is a way for the Harper government to use, and I mean use in a negative way, to use the victims to punish the criminals. So not only are they punished via the law, but now they are also punished via the victims to forward their radical Harper conservative agenda. What makes this sick is in doing it this way, he not only makes the criminals suffer, with whom you may not have any sympathies for, but also the victims suffer because under this arrangement, they have little hope of accessing the social services they so obviously are entitled to because the government has abdicated its social and fiscal responsibility. You might now ask me, what responsibility? Well, as I mentioned at the start, there are three actors in delivery of justice: criminal, victim, and the state. In the olden days of vigilantism, the victim responsible for justice. That is, if someone did you wrong, you got some people together, tracked down the criminal, and extracted your vengeance on them. Of course, this meant that a number of innocent people were strung up. Oops, sorry. Gangs are not always objective. Think lynch mob. This could also end up being a classic clan feud. Think Hatfields and McCoy. An endless cycle of violence dressed up as justice. So society evolved past the eye for an eye, realizing that it only led to the land of the blind. Yet crime needs to be stopped. Criminals need to be punished. So we traded vengeance for justice. Victims gave up their right of vengeance to the state. The state promised in exchange two things. First, justice would be met out to the criminals in the form of incarceration and the like. But also the state promised to help make the victims whole, to restore their faith in society as a safe place. It is the second part, the social contract, that if I let justice prevail, I will be helped by society, by the state in recovering from the harm the criminal inflicted upon me. This contract is often seen as part of the social safety net, medical, social, and psychological services, special services made available to those who are most at need, such as victims of crime. It is this responsibility that this act has sidestepped, transplanting responsibility from the state to the criminals. What's next? If criminals are responsible for the recovery of victims, will the victims be made responsible for the punishment of criminals? And as I started with, this is not an isolated example. Just like with First Nations or our veterans, the poor, the vast majority of Canadians who do not see their government in Ottawa, but the Harper government, whose agenda is not one to make the lives of Canadians better. No, the people are not their concern. Although some Canadians, corporations, multinationals, they do seem to get the ear of Harper. It seems the Harper Conservative government, beyond their propagandistic and hollow legislative mockeries, seem to turn a deaf ear to anyone who can't afford the $10,000 plate dinner at a Conservative fundraiser. We see a lot of legislation that facilitates pollution of the environment for the sake of big oil. The fawning and sycophantic efforts of Harper to make trade deals that help jobs and capital leave the country. We are seeing the social safety net being eroded away into nothingness, the shifting of government responsibility to some other less capable segment of society. We see this happening with healthcare. Just to give another example, at one time, when admitted to hospital for a surgical procedure, you were there for a week, even for a simple procedure, and then, when you recovered, you were sent home. No cost to you, beyond perhaps the fee for a TV in your room if you wanted. Yes, at one time, TV was seen as a luxury product. Well, actually, I guess you still get charged for it. So maybe it's still a luxury product if you're sick. And FYI, I just checked it out. You pay over $300 a month for basic TV. Wow. Anyway, back to my example. Now, the surgery is same-day care. You're only surgery for a couple hours. Then they send you home with instructions on how to change your bandages, some prescriptions, and perhaps a number of a home care nursing service, all of which are now your responsibility to pay for. Okay, yes, I may have idealized the past. It's rhetoric, so I shall wear my rose-colored glasses. In contrast to devolution of the social safety net, corporate welfare is growing continually, with a great example of almost $1 billion going to Chrysler to upgrade their plant. Perhaps a good investment, but an investment in victim recovery programs also seem at least equally as good. This used to be a nation where one could be proud of. Yet over the past decades, with an extreme acceleration in the decay over the past several years, it's hard to hold one's head up high and say, I am Canadian. Now it's more mumbled, I'm Canadian, sorry. It is the radical legislative agenda, such as the Increase Offenders Accountability for Victims Act, that so exemplifies why Harper and his government is not only harming Canadians, but ruining the possible future of Canada. It takes decades to make social progress, and yet only the stroke of a legislative pen to tear it all down. What do I mean? Let me close by providing an example from the global stage. Canada used to have a very nuanced, balanced, and neutral attitude towards the Middle East. Yet under the militarist, well, militarist for Canada, under Harper, we have become supportive of armed intervention around the globe, Libya, Iraq, Ukraine. We now state as official policy that Israel can do no wrong and that all Palestinians are terrorists. We side with the UN foreign policy more often than Obama does. Our reputation on the international stage has taken decades to earn. Remember, we invented peacekeepers. We were often brought in as honest, honorable brokers between conflicting states. Now, we can't even get a temporary seat on the Security Council. That would have been a sure thing even 10 years ago. But now we're seen as international extremists. And let me put that into context. Canada's won every election to the UN Security Council since the inception of the UN. Every 10 years, we get to take our place as one of the big 15 of nations. We are the fourth longest sitting non-permanent member. That is until the unprecedented defeat to Portugal in 2010. There's been a hollowing out of our society, and one that Harper is implementing with reckless abandonment. His reign will eventually end, but his destructive legacy will impact Canadians for generations to come. Never forget 2015. We'll be back after this break.
Another night's work well done. And so easy without that nuisance Spider-Man.
I didn't know you cared.
You!
Yes, Electro, and I'm going to short-circuit you once and for all.
You would have been better off in the hands of the police. You are no match for my power.
It takes more than power to win. It takes brains and knowing your enemy.
I'll pick my power against your brains any day. What was that?
That, my thieving fiend, is the result of brains.
Use your brain. Turn off all the lights when you leave a room. if every household in BC turned off one light bulb for 4 hours a day for 1 year, it would save enough electricity to power all the homes in Mission for an entire year. This Power Smart play brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart and CITR 101.9 FM.
And we're back. Well, as many of my listeners already know, Discovery Channel's annual Shark Week has finally passed. Yet again, there was a pseudo-documentary about how a shark the size of a submarine, hint a mega great white shark, might be swimming off the shores of South Africa. It's not. I say pseudo-documentary because these shows have about as much truth as Spinal Tap. And it's willful ignorance on the part of the writers and producers and production staff, because when you remove all the reconstructions and what would it be like if, big emphasis on the if part, well, what real evidence are they presenting? What real science? None. Most of the shows come with a disclaimer about the myth du jour. Its existence is highly controversial. Events have been dramatized, but many believe it exists to this day. Well, some people still believe the world is flat. Some think ghosts are real. Some think trickle-down economics work. The fact that people may believe in it is a very low bar. So these shows are usually based upon some fringe science or something someone might have seen. They then spin this one piece of anecdotal evidence or some wild speculation into a one-hour mockumentary on the Discovery Channel. And there's a growing trend in science shows on TV, which started with the kind of documentaries that I grew up with. Not the most exciting, but very informative and educational. However, as the social contract with broadcasters to both inform and entertain viewers shifted away from the unprofitable inform parts to the very profitable entertain parts, so you saw documentaries evolve over time. You start with a lackluster but very informative show about, oh, I don't know, about how life can exist around thermal vents in the deepest part of the ocean. The show would have lots of images of the vent, its flora and fauna, a narrator describing the scene, how these animals lived, how the vents formed. But these had trouble competing with flashy shows like Big Brother. To compete for eyes, they evolved. So then you got the enthusiastic science shows, often fronted by some charismatic scientist like Neil deGrasse Tyson or Brian Cox. Not as informative, because some time is lost to the inclusion of splashy graphics and the awe parts. By awe parts, I mean something like this.
This is Victoria Falls in Zambia. This waterfall stretches for almost 2 kilometers, making it the largest curtain of falling water in the world. But I'm not here to marvel at the scale of this wonder. I've come to see a much more delicate feature that appears above the water.
These magnificent rainbows are a permanent feature in the skies above Victoria Falls. Now, rainbows are a beautiful phenomenon, but I think they're even more beautiful when you understand how they're made, because they are a visual representation of the fact that light is made up of, well, all the colours of the rainbow.
Rays of light from the sun bend as they enter the water droplets. The light beams then reflect off the back of the droplets and are bent for a second time as they leave. This bending and reflecting splits the light, and the colours hidden inside the white sunlight are revealed. But colour can tell us much more, because understanding the reddening of the galaxies has given us a profound insight into the nature of the universe.
What we see as different colours are actually different wavelengths of light. So blue light has a relatively short wavelength, and then you go through green and yellow all the way to the red end of the spectrum, which has a very large wavelength.
Starlight is made up of countless different wavelengths, all the colours of the rainbow.
By upgrading the narrator with a personality, someone who could translate the, quote, wonder of learning, you could gain a certain celebrity feel, always a popular hook, but it is still considered science. Then, because you can't always afford a big name, some science shows went for the reality TV show format. You know, where the show is ostensibly about, I don't know, let's say the discovery of a new type of star. But half of the show is about the scientists trekking up some steep mountain to get to the observatory. How they are crammed into a small room with 20 other people, all of whom are competing for telescope time. Then, of course, you have the obligatory big problem that may make their whole efforts nada for nothing. Like, oh no, there are clouds. Will it impede our observation to observe this phenomena? It might just mean their entire expedition is a waste of time. It's almost always a false crisis because they already know that they actually got to see the star in question because these shows have been recorded weeks earlier and it's already gone through production all long before being aired on TV. By adding these unnecessary, at least to the science of the show, faux crises, or even real crises, it adds to the suspense, moving away from documentary and further along to be works of drama. Anyway, these reality science shows spend little time on the science and more time on the scientist, which, if the documentary was not about the star, but instead what it's like to be an astronomer, I'd have no problem with it. But if I wanted sociology, I'd watch that channel and not the space channel, if you get my point. Moving further from science, you get the docudrama, where you basically take the reality show format and remove the reality, lighten up even more on the science, and put the fictional part front and center. So, based on some science, some historically accurate elements, but dressed up into a more entertaining narrative. Very entertaining, but not a substitute for real documentaries, especially when the amount of reality is so variable. But not all fictional accounts are bad. There are fantasy science, or in keeping with my nomenclature, phantom entries. These, I confess, I really, really enjoy. These are your What Would Life on Another Planet Look Like? Again, science-based, but pure fiction. These shows make it clear that the subject matter is pure fiction, and what we're exploring is, given the science we currently understand, what could we speculate? The science is leading to speculation. For example, I like the Life on Other Worlds, which we know nothing about. Yet that said, knowing how life evolved on Earth, what can we speculate about life evolving on other planets? The biochemistry. The science is primary. The speculation is secondary, even if charted up to make it more competitive with real fiction. One could argue something like Alien Planet is an example of this. But there's a line that the Discovery Channel crosses, where it shreds the line between fiction and reality. They take something like What Would Life Be Like on Another Planet, and then rebrand it. Have we found life on another planet? Are there extraterrestrial beings living in Yellowstone Park? Or let's take Megalodon, for example. A fantumentary title might have something, What If Extinct Animals Were Still Around? Or Living with Megalodon, What Would It Be Like? These are fantasy and speculations. But no, the Discovery Channel, it calls its pseudomentary Megalodon, the monster shark that lives. One could be excused if you might think Megalodon was really still around based on the title. And here's where the Discovery Channel has lowered itself to become the tabloid scientish channel. They take interviews with real scientists who are treating the subject matter as fantasy. But then Discovery Channel cuts these interviews in such a way as to remove sort of the speculative intent of the scientist. They manipulate them into sounding like they are supporting the pulled out of their arse show titles. So you'd get a real quote saying something like, if Megalodon were alive today, it's a large animal that would likely feed on whales. If we looked at the fossil evidence, we have whale bones with Megalodon bite marks. They definitely fed on whales. Well, that becomes, in the Discovery Channel cut, it's a large animal that would likely feed on whales. We have whale bones with Megalodon bites. They definitely feed on whales. The original is clearly fantasy. The latter blurs the issue, and on purpose. And thus we can turn to Shark of Darkness, Wrath of Submarine, which, according to Discovery Channel, is, and I quote, said to be the deadliest great white shark of all time,
Submarine is a 30-foot great white shark that has terrorized the shores of South Africa for decades. Locals believe this shark is responsible for countless fatal attacks, but its existence has never been proven.
First, I should point out that a submarine is not 30 feet long, not even close. So even before the show begins, we have in our minds a submarine, like something you would see in a World War II movie. But those subs are like 200 or 300 feet long, 10 times longer than the 30-foot number used in a show. So we already have sensationalism in the title. It goes downhill from there. The premise of the show is actually an urban legend made up in the 70s by a journalist who wanted to see how gullible people were, and I guess how gullible TV channels masquerading as science news could be. There is no, none, nada evidence that this was true. A quick internet search shows that this has been exposed as a hoax from day one. But that assumes Discovery Channel producers were duped. But that explanation quickly vaporizes when you learn that the whole show was faked. That fuzzy film that purported to show what could be submarine was actually CGI. It wasn't even real. The people interviewed, the so-called experts, all actors. The events mentioned, such as submarine's attack on a whale-watching boat, never happened. There seems to be no more science in this show in a whole host of pseudomentaries than you'd find in some great cinema like Sharknado. Okay, that's one thing. You get the dumbing down of society, which sadly is not limited to Shark Week or the Discovery Channel. But there's some real damage done by Shark Week, the vilification of sharks. Sharks are on par with whales for being the aquatic megafauna least likely to be around the turn of the next century. Partly from overfishing for their fins, partly because they're bycatch. Bycatch is all that other fish that gets swept up when you get your sardines or cods, and they're usually just killed and thrown over the side. Of course, they also suffer from the fact that, as apex predators, the more fish we take from the ocean, the less there is for the sharks, lest the sharks starve to death. Sharks also suffer from a reproductive system that is, how shall we put it, slow and few, which in the long run seems to have worked well for them. But since the planet has been infected with the virus called man, well, not good news for the shark. Sharks are under extreme pressures that are pushing them to extinction. If we don't do something, as I said, most of them, the most iconic ones, like the great white, the hammerhead, the whale shark, are likely only to be found in aquariums and old videos. So back to my point. Shows like Sharkageddon, yes, that's one of the show titles. Well, people unjustly fear sharks and are less likely to support conservation efforts toward them. To put this into a more hyperbolic context, like the Discovery Channel, how many people would support the preservation and conservation of Ebola now? You might say, Don, you said our fears are unjust. But hundreds of people are attacked each year by sharks. They are, after all, the killers of the ocean, no? Well, the quick answer is yes and no. Yes, if you're a seal or the like. Sharks love the tasty, fat little tidbits. But no, for us humans. Because, well, to a shark, humans are bony wastes of time. To put this into a context even I can understand, when a shark bites a human, almost always by accident, it's expecting a turkey dinner, maybe a chicken. But what it gets is a crow, and a scrawny crow at that. The reason most attacks are on surfers is because from underneath, a swimming surfer with board looks a lot like one of those little fat-packed seals. So the shark is almost as surprised as you are when it takes a nibble. Now, there are some sharks that are territorial and maybe a little mean. They will bite not to eat you, but to basically say, hey, get the hell off. This is my turf. And it may surprise you that very few people have ever actually been eaten by sharks. Most people who die from shark attacks actually bleed to death from said nibble. Well, even if they don't take you as a meal, they still are sharks with big nasty teeth. Okay, now the obligatory. What should we really be afraid of? Well, to spoil my own list, the animal that kills the most people per year are not sharks, but people. Wow! I bet you're all surprised. What, no? Okay, what if I told you the number two killer was mosquitoes? Which, to be fair, doesn't actually directly kill people, rarely. I've yet to hear of someone actually being drained of blood by these little suckers. Hey, that might actually be a good mockumentary for the Discovery Channel. No, but they do carry nasty diseases and parasites that are responsible for around 1 million deaths per year. The tsetse fly comes close with about 500,000. What? No one's surprised yet? Well, let's take a look at the top killer list again. Well, dogs rank high, about 30 to 168, depending on what list you're using. In fact, if you include rabies, that number jumps to thousands of deaths per year. Thanks, Fido. Of course, I grew up in the prairies, where there are a lot of horses and cows, which together, both of which kill almost 10 times more people each year than sharks do. That would be about 20 deaths a year in the U.S. attributed to cows, and another 20 to horses. And the single biggest killer of people, the one animal, sans human, that will surprise you? And by single, I mean species. So yes, all snakes and all spiders kill more people. But only one species that kills the most people is, you know, I was genuinely surprised that this animal kills more people than lions, tigers, more than crocodiles, more than bears and bees, by an order of magnitude. Those others are responsible for tens of deaths. But the big winner on my list, take that as you will, is the hippopotamus, or specifically the hippopotamide amphibious, which accounts for almost 3,000 deaths per year. Now, of course, the real mystery is how they managed to accumulate such a death toll. Maybe there are a lot of people swimming with hippos. Maybe hippos are a lot more stealthier than you think. Maybe they're really fat little homicidal ninjas. Oh yes, and how do these stack up to real shark deaths? Well, about one person a year is killed in North America from a shark attack. About six die globally. In fact, in sci-fi's Sharknado, the original, the death toll was 16. So characters in the movie were many times more likely to die in the movie than real people that have been killed by sharks in the real world. And you are much, much, much more likely to die from watching either that movie or the pseudomentaries on the Discovery Channel. So I hope this will inspire you to donate to your favorite Save the Shark charity, Never Eat Shark Fin Soup, and well, never turn your back on a hippo. They seem to have it out for us. We'll be right back after this break.
Subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes. Subscribe via iTunes or at RadioFreeThinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@RadioFreeThinker.com.
And we're back. Well, having just talked about how wrong the Discovery Channel gets science, I thought I would cover a number of other science myths you all are likely to believe but have totally wrong. Well, do we actually use only 10% of our brain? In honor or perhaps dishonor of the movie Lucy, we'll discuss how much of our brain we actually do use. So in the movie, we are told that people use only 10% of their brain, that if only we could somehow tap into that other 90%, we would be able to perform miracles such as telepathy, superhuman physical abilities, telekinesis, even mental time travel. I know a number of people who, from my social network, believe that this is true. Well, sorry to say, but in actuality, we use 100% of our brain. Not all the time, but over the course of the day, almost every part of our brain gets used to do one thing or another. How do we know this? Well, just hop on the internet and take a look at a number of fMRIs, and you'll see that our brain lights up everywhere. Oh yes, what's an fMRI? It stands for Functional Magnetic Resonance Imaging. To make an image, a glass of slightly radioactive sugar water is ingested. As the blood circulates, the parts of the body that are more active require more sugar. A magnetic camera of sorts can pick up the radioactivity of the sugar water. Thus, the more radioactivity, the more sugar, the more work being done. So fMRIs can tell us what part of the brain is active when doing particular tasks. This is how we know that more than 10% of our brain is being used. Beyond the fact that we use 100% of our brain at any one time or another, it may also interest you to know that our brain is a glutton. Of all the calories you ingest in a day, over 20% are used by the brain. If you think about it from an evolutionary standpoint, only using 10% of our brain doesn't make sense. Why would we develop such large organs and then use only a fraction of it? Evolutionary pressures would have caused it to wither away ages ago. Also, if you think about it from a medical perspective, there are people who've had strokes where a portion of their brain is damaged. So if we only use 10% of our brain, any stroke would likely have killed us. Or since stroke occurs anywhere in the brain, they would almost never have an effect on us because they would more likely affect the 90% of the brain we're not using. And before some irate listener calls me out, yes, most people suffer from microstrokes that are often only discovered when the brain is scanned for some other reason. That is, our brain can adapt well to microstrokes without us ever really being aware of it. So could one not argue that maybe we have major strokes in that 90% unused area and it's just never affected our lives? We're never aware of it because we really only need a small part of our brain. Well, evidence of these unfelt strokes would quickly have come to light. Why? Well, the number of people who do get brain scans have increased greatly over the years. And well, we would see people with huge unfelt strokes, but we don't see this evidence. Also, studies on cadavers would show major strokes. Now, every non-microstroke always seems to equate to some bad news for that person. Now, you might say, everyone knows we only use 10% of our brain. How could such a myth become common knowledge? Well, some research points to a turn of the last century psychologist, William James, who was a big proponent of the idea that most people did not live up to their true potential. This he applied to our mental abilities as well. If only we tried harder, we could, and I'm putting words into James' mouth, but I think it's a fair paraphrase, I believe. If only we tried harder, we could move beyond achieving only 10% of our potential and realize 100%. If only we used positive thinking or something like that. It was not an empirical statement and was made at the dawn of our understanding of the brain. This characterization was taken on by his contemporaries. Undoubtedly, the biggest boost for the self-help entrepreneurs came from when the famous adventurer and journalist Little Thompson attributed the 10% of the brain claim to William James. Thompson did so in the preface he wrote in the 1936 to one of the best-selling self-help books of the time, Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People. The myth has gained steam ever since. Okay, now I just point out that the brain is a glutton for sugar, that it uses a high percentage of our calorie intake. So obviously, the more we have of it, sugar that is, the more active our brain is. The more active the brain, the more active and fidgety we become. So logic dictates sugar makes us hyper. No, this is most often heard from moms or dads who swear that after giving little Johnny a sugar treat like a chocolate bar, he jumps around and becomes quite a handful. It turns out this is expectation bias on the parts of parents and, well, probably likely all of us in the right context. There's been no scientific study that shows reliably that sugar has any effect on people, be they children or adults. However, studies have shown when a parent is told that their child has consumed a bunch of sugar, irrespective of whether that child has actually consumed the sugar, be it candy, pop, or what have you, those parents are more likely to report their child as hyperactive. They are more likely to be critical of their child's behavior and more likely to maintain control over the child. This is also an example of confirmation bias. When a child is at a birthday or Halloween party or the like, we tend to remember the rancorous nature of the kids. We attribute to cake and candy, and thus sugar equals hyperactivity. So remember the party with lots of sugar, but not the breakfast cereal that often contains more sugar than cake or chocolate bars. We also ignore the fact that, well, it's a party. Everyone's excited. That's what people do at parties, with or without cake. Okay, from celebration of life to afterlife. A number, thankfully not a law, of people in my circle are under the impression that your hair and fingernails continue to grow after death. Zombie dreadlocks! So, do your nails get longer? Does the hair lengthen? Yes and no. With more emphasis on the no. Now, some people think this is a silly question. When you're dead, you're dead. But it's not inconceivable that some cells may live on. If you remember a few months back, there was a viral video going around about an exploding dead whale. Why did it explode? Because the bacteria in the whale's stomach, bacteria that's always been there, well, they lived on even though the whale as a whole died. Normally, a digestive system will expunge the gas that these bacterial tenants make. Yes, I'm talking farts. But once dead, that gas pipeline shuts down, and the gas builds up, and sometimes to the point of explosion. So it is conceivable that hair and nail follicles could live on even after our heart stops in the same way that bacteria might. It is true there is the appearance of growth, but not because our hair or nails live beyond us. No, they die when we die. Why does it look like that? Well, there's no polite way of saying it, but, well, we shrivel up when we die. The skin dehydrates and contracts. This means that more of the nail is exposed, not that more of it is growing. The same for the hair. It's not growing, it's just the skin receding. Trivia fact. Funeral homes will give the dearly departed a healthy rubdown of moisturizing cream to reduce the effects of the dehydration all corpses exhibit. I mean, who wants to see dear old Aunt Prunella look like her name? Or at least any more of a prune than she already was. Am I right? Sorry. Speaking of nails, the hand is a fascinating piece of engineering. However, there are some who worry that we may be damaging it by cracking our knuckles. We have all likely heard at one point or another that we should not crack our knuckles because it'll cause arthritis in those joints when we get older. Well, this is an empirical claim, but one that's almost impossible to test in the real world. So is this fact or fiction? Well, one individual, a Donald Unger, started a longitudinal study. That's a study over a long period of time. For 60 years, he would crack the knuckles on his left hand every day and never on his right. After performing this experiment, it was concluded that he had no arthritis in either hand. Thus, knuckle cracking does not seem to cause arthritis. He actually won an Ig Nobel Prize for his effort. Now, a number of my science-savvy listeners will point out that this had a subject group of one, and it was only one experiment. So far from conclusive, really. But seriously, how many of us would have had the discipline to do this? That said, the cracking of knuckles is caused by a decrease in the pressure of the synovial fluid, a fluid that acts as a cushioning agent in our joints and reduces friction. As pressure decreases, small bubbles can form. Pressing on these bubbles causes the cracking sound. Think bubble wrap. Under normal circumstances, there seems to be no mechanism for these pops to cause any real damage. That said, if cracking is accompanied by pain, it can signify joint damage. Did you know that your tendons can also make this noise? However, this has been shown to correlate with reduced tendon strength over time. So snap them knuckles, but not them tendons. Speaking of complexity of the hand, you may have also been warned never to toss a penny off a very tall building because you could kill someone on the ground below. Well, relax, toss away. Although you may be sued for being a nuisance or an ass. Why? Well, it's not that you could not throw something over the edge of the Empire State Building or some similar tall building and kill someone. Think bowling ball. No, the thing that saves you from death by penny is the shape and mass of the penny. The shape means that it's more likely to fall like a leaf than a bullet. That dissipates a lot of the skull-cracking energy. Also, even at extreme heights, the mass prevents the penny from overcoming its aerodynamic handicaps. So ultimately, a little thwack on the ground is all you'd get. Think snapping someone with your fingers, maybe an elastic band. But your skull remained intact. However, don't try this on the moon. Absence of the air turbulence or cushioning effect, the penny could achieve fatal velocities. So it could kill you, but only on the moon. The same could be said if you tossed a loonie, and I believe even a gold dollar. But the thing you really have to worry about is not a tossed coin, but a tossed pen. Yes, in this case, the pen is mightier than the dollar. Because of the aerodynamics, think bullet-like shape, of our typical ballpoint pen, it could achieve a velocity exceeding 200 miles per hour, which could penetrate the human skull. Of course, the odds of being struck by a falling penny, that would be like, well, it'd be like being hit twice by lightning. Or to put it another way and to make an awkward segue, lightning never strikes twice, surely. Well, sadly to say, lightning often strikes the same place over and over and over again. To understand why, you need to understand how lightning works. In the atmosphere, usually but not always around clouds, an electrical imbalance occurs. Usually positive ions are collected. Nature hates imbalance, so it tries to find some way to introduce these positive ions to negative ions. This is often done by connecting the cloud formation with the Earth, usually via some electrical conductive material, metal, tree, golfer. Because the conditions that give rise to electrical storms are influenced by geography, they tend to form in the same locations over and over again. The fact that most tall objects are also permanent objects, or golfers, means that lightning often strikes the same area quite often. Not only do they strike the same area twice, but over a third of the strikes involve branching. That is, one bolt will hit the ground in more than one area. So not only have lightning strikes hit the same place more than once, you can have one strike hit more than one place at a time. Speaking of freaky behavior, we all know that the full moon causes people to go, well, a little loony. Some people have speculated that the moon's effects are blood somehow, something akin to the tides, and that this imbalance causes our erratic behavior. However, study after study shows that there's little to no correlation between crime sprees or emergency room visits and the full moon. Gravitationally, the moon has the same effect on us once every day. The only difference between a full moon and any other is the amount of light being reflected on the Earth. If there's any correlation between increased activity and the full moon, it might be with more light. People are more active, not more irrational. Speaking of full moon, it gets bright, but only on one side, right? Everyone knows Pink Floyd's classic Dark Side of the Moon, the group's nod that only half of the moon ever sees the light of, well, the sun. And well, it is more or less true that we only see one side of the moon. That does not mean the sun doesn't get to illuminate the entire surface. The term dark side of the moon refers to the fact that the moon is tidally locked to Earth. That means gravity keeps one side facing the Earth. Well, to put it more accurately, the moon rotates at such a speed that one moon day equals one moon year, or the time it takes it to revolve around the Earth. We call this a lunar month, or about 27 days. This means that as the moon rotates around the Earth, different parts of it are exposed to the sun. Thus, we get the different phases of the moon. So if we ever manage to build a moon base Alpha, they will be able to have a hydroponics lab that will be able to experience a similar daylight pattern as we do here, if only on a longer time scale. Remember, a moon day is like 27 days long. On the moon, one thing we may have to worry about is space bacteria. Luckily, we have a wide range of antibiotics to help us kill bugs here. However, the number of effective antibiotics have continued to decrease as bacteria become more and more resistant. One significant reason they gain resistance is their overuse of them. Many people will go to their doctors suffering from the flu or the cold and demand that they prescribe them antibiotics. These ignorant people, not only the people who demand ineffective medication, but even more unforgivably doctors who give in to the demand because they know the damage being done. So forgive me for the hard tone, but this behavior could spell the end of humanity. I call them ignorant, not because they're rude, but they believe in the false belief that antibiotics work on viruses, like the cold or the flu, and they don't. The CDC in the US estimates that tens of millions of prescriptions for antibiotics are given out to patients suffering from viral infections. The irony is they do nothing to help the patient. Using an antibiotic on a virus infection is like using a hammer to fix your TV. Nothing good will come of it. What is worse, by taking these antibiotics, you are affecting the bacteria in your body, which leads to antibiotic resistance. How? When we take antibiotics to kill bacteria, we need to take it for a long enough period of time to kill all the target bacteria, usually 2 or so weeks. However, your cold has nothing to do with bacteria, so you will likely recover before the medication has been used up. This means that if you have bad bacteria in your system, not bad enough to cause you illness, but could kill someone who is immune suppressed, think someone in intensive care, well, that bad bacteria that survives your unnecessary treatment, they are more likely to be resistant to the antibiotic in question. Only the strong survive. This means that you've bred a more drug-resistant strain that could kill someone else not as healthy as you. Currently, there are several strains of bacteria that were completely controllable a decade or so ago, but are now untreatable because they have learned resistance to antibiotics thanks to the overuse of those antibiotics. So I hope that helps clear some things up, some myths we had, some falsehoods that we may have been harboring within our brain. So before I sign off, I'm just going to give a little bit of web wisdom at the end of the show. It's going to give a bit better of an explanation about how bacteria become drug resistant and the real impact of drug resistant bacteria. So listen to it and take heart. Don't abuse your antibiotics. This is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
What potential disasters keep you up at night? Meteor strikes? Supervolcanoes? World War III? World War Z? Those are all pretty scary, and we didn't even mention climate change, but there's one other immediate terrifying scientific problem that rises above the rest. Superbugs. I'm not talking about giant spiders of Mirkwood or tracker jackers. I'm talking about antibiotic-resistant bacteria, which, by the way, are everywhere. Antibiotics are pretty incredible. Since the discovery of penicillin, they have extended the average human life by about 10 years. A good percentage of the people watching this right now are only alive today because at some point, an antibiotic saved their life. But we're facing a little bit of a crisis. Antibiotics are starting to lose their effectiveness as bacteria continue to outsmart our technology. And I don't want to make you too paranoid here, but the consequences could be big. Remember that little thing called the Black Death? The pandemic that ravaged Europe and Asia in the 1300s, killing about 25 million people? That wouldn't have happened if antibiotics were a thing back then. But if our drugs stop working now, could it happen again? The U.S. Centers for Disease Control estimates that 23,000 Americans died in 2012 from antibiotic-resistant bacteria. And the World Health Organization says that in 2010, about 500,000 people were infected with a resistant strain of tuberculosis, a third of whom died. A post-antibiotic era could essentially mean the end of modern medicine, and suddenly a simple operation, sinus infection, or a scraped knee could once again have the potential to kill. Now, I'm not saying you should be worried about this. Actually, yeah, I'm saying you should be worried about this. When Scottish physician Alexander Fleming got out of bed one September morning in 1928, he had no idea that he was about to change the world. Fleming had seen countless soldiers die from infected wounds, and since the First World War ended, he'd been working hard to find better antibacterial agents. He was a good guy and a good scientist, but he was also a bit of a slob. So that morning, he was straightening up a stack of petri dishes where he'd been growing Staphylococcus bacteria when he noticed mold in one of the dishes. Now, his lab was messy enough that that wasn't that weird, but what caught his eye was that all around the mold, the bacteria was dead. He later identified that mold as Penicillium notatum. Years of experimentation followed, and after enlisting the help of researchers Howard Florey and Ernst Chain, the team figured out how to grow and use the fungus to treat bacterial infections. Mass production began during World War II, and by D-Day in 1944, all Allied soldiers had penicillin, the world's first antibiotic. For their work, Fleming, Florey, and Chain were awarded the Nobel Prize. And for the next 50 years or so, antibiotics were unbeatable, saving lives left and right. But lately, they've struggled to perform as well as they used to. Before we talk about exactly what antibiotics are and how they work, you have to understand what they're up against.
Bacteria.
Take a look around your room. Everything. Your chair, your sandwich, your dog, your body, inside and out. It's all covered in millions and millions of different single-celled bacteria. They can pretty much survive anywhere, even in radioactive waste and in the absence of light or oxygen. Unlike viruses, which need a host cell to reproduce and survive, bacteria can thrive everywhere because they can share their genetic material with each other. This is the key to their evolving resistance to antibiotics. While some bacteria have genes that make them resistant to, like, heat so they can live in boiling water, other bacteria may be resistant to penicillin, and both kinds can share what they know. We get our genes from our parents, and what we're born with, we're stuck with for our whole lives. Bacteria, however, like to do things a little differently. They don't need to use traditional reproduction to pass their genes along. They can use something called horizontal gene transfer to swap genetic information like you swap Pokemon cards. And one of the best ways bacteria acquire new genes is to loot their neighbor's body when they degrade and die. This process is known as transformation, although some pathologists have dubbed it the funeral grab. It happens when bacteria are in a special physiological state called competence, during which they can scavenge bits of foreign DNA from their environment. So say Bobby Bacterium dies, and then Benny Bacterium creeps up and grabs whatever genes it wants. So if Bobby was resistant to cold and Benny grabbed that gene, now Benny is suddenly cold resistant, and if Bobby was resistant to a certain antibiotic, boom! Now Benny is too. Another way bacteria exchange genetic material is by passing viruses, also known as transduction. Viruses can infect bacteria just like any other organism, and because viruses are just bits of RNA or DNA, they can jump into a bacterium, latch onto some genes, and then jump to a different bacterium, transferring those genes in the process. So that's like I caught the flu from you, and with it, I got your mother's eyes. The third way bacteria exchange traits is through conjugation, which is kind of like sex. So let's say Bobby and Benny E. coli are feeling frisky, and Bobby builds a gene-passing connection over to Benny, and when they break apart, Benny can now do something that only Bobby could do before. So you see where this is going. A particular strain of bacteria could suddenly become resistant to an antibiotic by catching a virus, robbing a dead friend, or by having sex with a live one. And, just like the evolution of any other organism, the bacteria that acquire the toughest, most resistant traits become more fit, more adaptable to a range of environments, and are thus more likely to survive and thrive. So in a way, the superbug phenomenon that's going on right now is kind of like watching natural selection play out in fast forward, which is cool and scary. But now you have a sense of how high the stakes would be if, say, a resistant strain of the plague started moving around the globe. But luckily, for the last 70 years or so, we've had antibiotics, also called antimicrobials or antibacterials. And they work by either destroying the bacteria or slowing their growth enough that the human body's own immune system can finish the job. Basically, an antibiotic is a selective poison designed to find, bind, and kill bacteria without damaging their host cells in your body. These drugs usually work by attacking a unique bacterial target, like a particular protein, or a bacterial process, like the way they build a cell wall or metabolize sugar. For example, most bacteria build their cell walls using a specific combination of sugars and amino acids, a combination that our cells don't use. So antibiotics like penicillin block the production of that material, so the bacteria's walls weaken and burst. Other antibiotics may attack bacteria's metabolic pathways. All cells require folic acid, aka vitamin B9, to function. This vitamin easily passes into human cells, but it can't enter bacterial cells, so bacteria have to make their own. The sulfa family of antibiotics, made from a sulfur compound, works by disrupting the production of this vitamin, thus inhibiting their growth. And then there's tetracycline, which combats infection by attacking how bacteria make proteins. Tetracycline can get through bacterial membranes and disrupt protein production enough to inhibit cell growth, while human cells remain safe. But as amazing as antibiotics are, they've got a really smart enemy, and bacteria have a few effective ways of wriggling out of the crosshairs. For one, some bacteria can basically just barf up the antibiotic when it gets inside its cell. They use their chemical energy to fuel what are essentially pumps that spit the antibiotics right back out of the cell before it can do any harm. They may also get kinda sneaky and change the drug's target so that the antibiotic can't find what it's supposed to destroy. Because many antibiotics work only on a very specific molecule, if a bacterium can replace that molecule or rearrange its structure, that antibiotic can't do its job. Bacteria can also go on the offensive and basically make a weapon that looks for and breaks down antibiotics. For example, some strains can produce enzymes that destroy penicillin by breaking open the compound that's basically its active ingredient. And of course, once a bacterium has figured out a good resistance, it can pass that information along to its neighbors through sex or viruses or pilfering, and then it's on to other human and animal hosts who travel all over the globe by land, sea, and air, and then it's goodbye drugs. Hello, plague. So now you might be wondering, well, can't we just develop new antibiotics? Well, we've already gone after bacteria's most obvious targets, and what's left are increasingly difficult alternatives. Basically, new classes of antibiotics will be a lot harder to discover and develop. We're probably not going to find them in a moldy lunchbox. However, researchers at Oregon State University and other institutions around the world are working on a promising new type of antibacterial agent called PPMOs. Lab studies have shown that one type of PPMO has been really effective at controlling some kind of bacteria that I can't pronounce, which happens to be responsible for a lot of hospital infections. PPMOs are lab-synthesized analogs of DNA or RNA. They target a bacterium's genes instead of just disrupting its cellular function. Although they haven't been tested on humans yet, PPMOs may offer a totally different approach to fighting bacterial infections, and possibly even other diseases with genetic components. Other researchers are looking at fighting superbugs with viruses. Bacteriophages are viruses that infect and destroy bacteria and spread to other bacteria. These phages are naturally occurring and can be found all over the place, including soil, river water, and the human body. Each phage is specific to a particular type of bacteria and needs the proper host to multiply. The more targets it has, the faster the virus spreads and kills, making it especially effective against high concentrations of bacteria or chronic infections. You only need a tiny bit of the virus, which can be administered through a cream or a spray. And so far, they don't seem to infect human cells, and they haven't contributed to antibiotic resistance. So even though the risk of superbugs taking over the world is real and scary, we do have some reasons to be hopeful, and in the meantime, there are some things you can do to help. First, it's important to understand when you should and shouldn't use antibiotics. You don't want to gobble them up every time you feel kinda poopy. You might have a virus, and antibiotics won't help that. Antibiotics should be a last resort, reserved for serious infections when other treatments haven't worked. And if you do need them, make sure you take them exactly as prescribed until the bottle is empty. Stopping early only makes the surviving bacteria stronger. Likewise, Never take antibiotics without a prescription. No passing along leftover medication. And of course, make sure you wash your hands, use soap, get vaccinated. If you prevent illness, we prevent the need for medications in the first place. The future peoples of Earth will thank you.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at RadioFreeThinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@RadioFreeThinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way. Cosmos is full.
Join in celebrating a truly unique UBC occasion with Professor